Hi, welcome to the Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Professor Barry Eichengreen and Ira Harris. Professor Eichengreen is Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a former Senior Policy Advisor at the International Monetary Fund. He is the author of many books, including his new book, In Defense of Public Debt. Ira is hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently another time period there as well. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
It's an honor.
Great. Let's begin with your new book. What is that about? What is the focus and some of the themes?
Well, we started on the book to describe the positive uses to which governments and states have put their borrowing capacity before COVID-19. We wanted to describe how public debt issuance has been used to defend states and societies against external threats. Governments issue debt in wartime, in other words, but governments have issued debt in order to invest in the infrastructure needed for economic development. Starting in the 19th century, they borrowed in order to build roads and bridges, ports, urban infrastructure, and so forth. When we get to the 20th century and we see governments borrowing also to finance social programs and transfer payments, spending now and hoping to repay later becomes a bit more problematic, one might say. But we wanted to redress the balance, and then COVID-19 came along and kind of made the case for us. I think a government that hadn't borrowed, hadn't issued debt in order to meet an existential crisis, a public health emergency, and what could have turned into a very severe economic crisis, would have been regarded as derelict or illegitimate. So I think the argument in the book that public debt has its uses, if utilized judiciously, is probably more timely now than it would have been in February of 2020.
And do you feel that the current methods and ways of addressing the debt are similar to what has happened in the past? Can you relate some of those methods specifically or approaches?
So in the book, we look at a variety of episodes where governments have emerged from a national emergency with very heavy debt burdens. Britain, after the French and Napoleonic Wars, had a debt to GDP ratio of 200%, twice levels in the US and European Union at the moment. And it brought that debt down to much lower levels on the eve of World War I by running budget surpluses, by running substantial primary budget surpluses, in other words, net of interest payments for years, for decades, for the better part of a century. The United States did the same thing in the half century following our Civil War. We look at a number of other historical episodes, where the same has been true. But I think there are real questions about whether our more polarized polities, our more politicized environment will enable our societies to turn to fiscal consolidation, to run budget surpluses in the future, to offset necessary deficits in the recent past, in the same way that has been true historically. There have also been episodes, some positive on balance, like after World War II, some negative on balance, like after World War I, where societies have used inflation to erode the real value of the debt, to increase the denominator of the debt to GDP ratio through inflation. And there are some people like the English economist, my friend Charles Goodhart, who suggest that inflation is coming and will be used to effectively erode the real value of the debt. He sees inflation rates of 5 to 10%, chronic inflation of 5 to 10% going forward. I don't think we have the same scope to use inflation to erode the real value of the debt that some societies have had in the past, because our financial markets are more agile or articulated. Investors are going to turn to short maturity debt much more quickly. And I also think that stability culture is deeply ingrained in the central banking community. So some people are questioning that belief at the moment. I think that commitment to price stability is still intact. And the third way that societies have dealt with inherited debt burdens is by growing their economies, again, by successfully growing the denominator of the debt to GDP ratio. That's the painless way of dealing with an inherited debt burden. Maybe all the things we've learned during the pandemic, digitization and telehealth and podcasts, will translate into faster productivity growth going forward. That would be nice, although there's no evidence at all of an acceleration in productivity growth in the data at the moment. So I conclude that what the United States and our societies more generally will have to do is restore their ability to borrow, deal with heavy inherited debts through a multi-pronged approach, where they turn to fiscal consolidation when the time is right, when they avoid deflation and maybe run 2 or 3% inflation rates, and where they successfully grow the economy. That's the best we can hope for.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, Ira, on these techniques?
Well, I'm not sure, but when Rogoff and Reinhardt wrote the book This Time It's Different, a lot of people forget that one of the criteria that Rogoff uses was a 4 to 6% inflation rate over a 3 to 5 year period to help alleviate some of the stress from the overhang of the debt. So I don't think that this is anything new, but I know that Professor Eichengreen is really one of the best sources for the issue of the gold standard and things that took place, of course, through the aftermath of the American Civil War to the aftermath of the of World War I. So there was something that held everybody's feet to the fire, so to speak, which I don't think exists now. Ultimately, yes, the existential question, and I hope to get into the discussion, is about the dollar, because the dollar has a phenomenal, if we go back to Giscard d'Estaing and, of course, Jacques Roof, an exorbitant privilege. But I'm one who thinks, and I think this is what confronts the central bank. So I'm not as sanguine about the outcome of this, because I think the central banks have, because of the role of the dollar and the policies that we embarked upon post great financial crisis. I hate that phrase, but I guess we're stuck with that. That so much dollar debt. Dollar denominated debt, because the dollar is a funding currency, very much so. Now, you'd think that the euro would actually be more so, but the dollar holds there because interest rates for many highly qualified borrowers around the world are, of course, close to zero. So they keep adding on the debt and the debt. And as Gillian Tett wrote that wonderful column in the FT a couple weeks ago, why we have to be concerned about the debt, using the Institute of International Finance data, they have at the end of the second quarter, global debt growing to $296 trillion. Now, of course, that's not all in dollars, but the interest, interest is the wrong word. And it's kind of scary thing is that global debt grew by 10%. So that was $26 trillion in the second quarter. Now, yes, the interesting thing was that the debt to GDP ratio for the global numbers actually decreased, because we know that we experienced a really nice quarter of growth in the second quarter of 2021. But I mean, this is where we're going to get to. And I think the dollar is a major concern here, because if the Fed moves to change and rein in what the popular parlance, tapering, if they move first, I think the dollar then rises. And I think that's a terrible situation for the global economy. And I think then we'll get what none of us want. And Lacey Hunt and David Rosenberg keep talking about a deflationary or a disinflationary period. So I think this dollar issue is going to be paramount going forward.
Well, Ira raises a lot of issues there under the banner of the dollar. I am aware that people are pondering the possibility of another taper tantrum like that in 2013, when the Fed did begin to normalize, as it were. And now that it's clear the Fed is going to begin tapering asset purchases toward the end of the year and raising interest rates next year, I think we can be pretty confident about that. It's the markets in this case, and not me, that are relatively sanguine in the belief that the Fed has prepared everybody for its normalization, and that we're not going to see another taper tantrum like that of 2013. I agree with Ira that that's something about which we should not be sanguine. And there are plenty of emerging markets and low-income countries that are going to find it difficult to deal with higher interest rate funding environment and a stronger dollar, which are likely to be coming.
You're just a little more sanguine than I am, because I worry about this dollar. Because to me, if you got a 10% appreciation in the dollar because the Fed was the first one to move, and U.S. rates are, even though nominal rates in the U.S., the real effective yield is, the negative real yield is so low. And going back to 2013, so I think it's really important to look at that. It wasn't, the Fed was right to do it. I think the pain was that Bernanke panicked because he saw what markets were doing. But sometimes you have to let market, I'm not talking about crashes and massive liquidations. I don't think we would have seen that. And I was trading and still trading every day in the face of it. And I was actually cheering it on because I thought it would really be well contained, the market. But the Fed seems to, they won't let things really play out, because Bernanke and company weren't raising interest rates yet. I thought Bernanke was actually taking the right task, which was starting to taper and then see where that goes before he started raising the Fed funds rate. We were still, and as he would say, the effect of lower bound. I think that Jerome Powell made a categorical mistake, and I said it in real time, by going to both in 2018, which resulted in him pivoting in January of 2019, because he did what in December of 2018 Stan Druckenmiller called a double shotgun approach, because he was doing what Peter Buchvar, of course, labeled quantitative tightening as well as raising interest rates. I think that was that error. So I think they get very fearful, but I think, you know, they have to look at, you know, I'm speaking from a market perspective, from a practitioner of the market, is that you have to look at it and go, well, we have to start exiting here. We have to, or normalizing, whatever that means in today's world, but we have to start exiting from this policy. And if the markets can't adapt to it, and I think that Professor Eichengreen is absolutely right. The markets right now are saying, oh, they're yawning. It's a yawn. Okay, you're going to taper because, first of all, they don't need the liquidity anyway. That's just a fact. You can look at the reverse repo operations. You can look at the interest on excess reserves. The market has told them for a long time, you don't need this excess liquidity because it's not really making its way into the economy. It makes it onto the Fed balance sheet. So I think they could have ended it a long time ago and then actually get to where they seem to all want to be following Richard Clarida's speech yesterday. They all want to start raising rates, but they learned from 2018 that they don't want to do them jointly. So they want to taper and be in a hurry to taper so they can then begin actually start raising the Fed funds rate.
I would add two things. One, the difference between now and then, between 2021 and 2013, is that in 2013, Bernanke surprised the markets by saying the T word. And this time the Fed has been at pains to signal, to communicate ad nauseum in advance what is coming. And I'm not in the business of judging whether the Fed is right or wrong, but I am in the business of conjecturing that because the Fed has communicated, signaled more clearly in advance what it's going to do, once it does it, the effects will be less disruptive and will produce less volatility. The other thing I would say is that my book and my work are about public debt issued by governments. And governments have made progress at developing the capacity to issue debt denominated in their own currencies as opposed to the dollar. So therefore, what happens to the dollar exchange rate is of less consequence for their public finances than it had been in the past. There's lots of corporate debt out there denominated in dollars, to be sure. Lots of Evergrande's offshore bonds are denominated in dollars. And what starts out in the private sector can be socialized if things go badly wrong. But the public finances of a substantial number of middle-income countries are stronger than they were a decade or two ago and less dependent on the dollar exchange rate than they were a decade or two ago.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the classic and probably the best example is Mexico. I mean, Mexico issues a lot of their sovereign debt in pesos. They pay up for it, but the market is really willing to accept it. And the Mexican peso has been crisis-free, I think. You know, they may suffer political crises, but they have been crisis-free, I would probably say, since 1995. So I absolutely, for certain countries. But there are still massive amounts of, as you would, private sector, you know, corporate debt around the world and household debt. It's no different to me. And we have a pretty good example of that. It was the Swiss franc and what happened in Eastern Europe and in Central Europe in 2015, because Swiss interest rates were lower than in the rest of Europe. The peg was supposedly guaranteed by the Swiss National Bank. In fact, January 8th, a week before they actually pulled the peg, the S&B swore that that peg was sacrosanct. And so a lot of people were taking out loans denominated in Swiss francs. Well, a week later, the Swiss, under, because of huge market pressure, pulled the peg, and the losses as the Swiss franc appreciated in a very short time were enormous. And those lawsuits are still being settled as we sit here and talk. So I think it provides a view as to how, you know, global the private sector in so many different nation states are way too borrowed up in dollars. And I think it's been one of the negative effects of this policy, because the dollar is the cornerstone of the global economy. And therefore, if the dollar were to move, not of course it'll never move like the Swiss move, but if it started to ratchet up, because basically all those loans make people short dollars, because those are dollars you have to pay back or default on, and that would be disastrous. So I think the Swiss provides a model to as a signal for us to be very careful here as to how the dollar goes. And I think I know the Fed would stand there and say the dollar is not our bailiwick, but I would bet that Janet Yellen is very aware of this potential and be interested to see how they confront it.
Two things about that I would add. Number one, the move in the Swiss franc was sudden and big.
Yep.
Because it had been pegged to the euro effectively, and that was no longer viable. You're quite right about it no longer being viable. But the dollar isn't pegged to anything, and I don't think it is likely to move as violently all at once as did the franc in 2015. Number two, the Polish and Czech cases you describe, where residents were taking out home mortgages denominated in Swiss francs, that's a great example of terrible bank regulation. The local authorities should have prevented their banks and Swiss and Italian banks doing business in their economies, and Austrian banks, from sourcing, funding themselves in Swiss francs and lending in their countries in that foreign currency. So my co-authors and I talk in our book about historical examples of the diabolic loop, how problems in the banking system can create problems in the public finances when you've got to recapitalize the banks, or how problems in the public finances can create problems in the banking system when you force feed government bonds to the banks. And the cases you describe are yet other examples of this unhealthy symbiosis.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely great points. And it's funny, because I was just traveling for 10 days, and I have a tendency to pack up my bag with speeches and papers I read once, and I saved them. So I have this one. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because there was a BIS working paper, and I give the BIS a lot of credibility. Yeah. I think their research is actually pretty good. And it was from January of 2015. It was a BIS paper number 483, Global Dollar Credit is the title of it, Links to U.S. Monetary Policy and Leverage. And it was done by Robert McCauley and Patrick McGuire and Vladislav Sushko. So it was an inch, and it really deals with the concept of how much leverage borrowing there is out there in dollars. And this is from 2015, January. So every bit as much as the Swiss. And I agree with you totally. I mean, this is not a dollar peg, although there are others who peg to the dollar. So a rising dollar, yeah, I'm not sure about that either. But we will see. There are some, I think, some major fault lines that exist in the global economy that are going to have to be dealt with. And you're right. The regulators really need to be aware. And on top of this, they cannot be lagging this situation. They have to be ahead of it.
And a question I have on from your recent writings in the Project Syndicate, you mentioned monetary authorities are increasingly expected to address issues such as climate change and inequality. Just wondering your thoughts, how central banks and governments, how their policies will change, in what ways will they change to address these issues?
Well, let me address the role of central banks specifically. To start, the worry people have is that if central banks continue to broaden their mandates and address not only target not only price stability, or not only, as with the Fed's dual mandate, price stability and high employment, but they also begin to worry about climate change and inequality and whatever else is on the economic, political, and social agenda. Their independence may ultimately be jeopardized. Independence for a central bank is politically tolerated only when the central bank is given a specific mandate and when it can be judged in terms of its success in meeting that mandate. So if a central bank tries to target something it doesn't control, like inequality, then it can be criticized for not making progress. Similarly with climate change, we won't know for years how successful the agencies of government, and perhaps including the central bank, are in mitigating and adapting to climate change. So for all those reasons, I used to be of the view that central banks should stick to their knitting. They should stick to their mandates, narrowly defined, only target variables that they can affect and where they can be judged in terms of their success or failure. Increasingly, I worry about climate change and some of the other things that are affecting our society, however, as existential crises. During existential crises, during World War II, the Fed had to aid the Treasury in funding the exceptional operations of government. So I no longer think that central banks can stand aside and say climate change and other existential crises are for other agencies of government to address and not us. I think the Fed has to make clear what it can and cannot achieve in terms of climate change. I think it, as a regulator, can do more to ensure that financial institutions are prudently taking on board the risks to their portfolios of potential climate-related events. And maybe it can do more like the European Central Bank is doing in terms of favoring green bonds over other securities. I'm a little uncomfortable about saying central banks need to worry more and do more about issues such as climate change, but that's where I'm at the moment.
Mm-hmm. In your thoughts, Ira?
Well, we had left off with the issues of how much responsibility the central banks, especially the Fed, was taking on. And yes, of course, I go back to the infamous statement comment to Bernanke in 2012 by Chuck Schumer, when he said, "You're the only game in town." And I cringed when that was said, and I've been cringing ever since, because I think that was right. And due to the politics that was taking place in Congress, there was an abdication of responsibility, and it put the burden on the Fed, and the Fed, but I thought, too readily accepted the burden and then everything that came with it. And it's been made more so by the ECB. I think the European Central Bank has really got some significant issues that they're going to have to face, which may make other problems really look like much simpler. But the European Union problems, especially now a change of government in Germany, and we'll see who's the finance minister, whether it's Lindner or not, with the FDP, then we're going to wind up back at the German Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe, waiting for a some type of decision. There's some very serious issues here. And on the green bonds, the problem of it is, I think that by pushing ESG, and there's been several articles about this. I always like to cite, somebody took Larry Fink to task because they pushed ESG,
But now there's a massive shortage. Of course, it's rising natural gas prices, and that's for a multitude of reasons. But some of it is the lack of finance that went into the rebuilding the gas drilling infrastructure. There is a shortage of gas, which is leading to shortages of fertilizer, which is going to lead to higher food prices. So we got a lot of issues here. Nothing's as simple as everybody wants to believe it to be. But if the Green Revolution, for lack of a better phrase, or the Green New Deal is to be financed, it may take central banks to buy those if there's no other buyers. But right now, there's plenty of buyers for that debt right now. But we know how fast things can change.
Just a last question on the effects of the COVID crisis and the post-COVID era on the global economy. How do you see inflation playing out, more of a transitory or a secular, you know, in terms of supply, demand forces, the reopening of the economy still ongoing, and supply chain disruptions in labor and in distribution?
Right. So there are lots of things going on at the moment that cause inflation to bounce around, from the supply chain disruptions to unexpected shifts in demand to changes in labor force participation. But I think we know that at the end of the day, central banks have the capacity to lean against increases in inflation, and somewhat more problematically, they have some tools like quantitative easing that they have used to lean against deflation. So it's really, I think, at the end of the day, not an argument or a discussion of the role of supply shocks and demand shocks, but rather whether you think central banks are going to retain the independence that they have increasingly enjoyed in recent decades, and whether they will use that independence to ensure a relatively low and stable rate of inflation. So as I said at the top, my view, my presumption is that central bank independence will be preserved in most countries.
Great. And your continuing thoughts, Professor Eichengreen, on the inflation question, also in light of Ira's comments with regards to the energy situation and the green agenda?
Yeah, just to finish the thought, inflation will be affected by supply chain disruptions and energy shortages and changes in labor force participation and changes in demand going forward. But at the end of the day, I think central bank independence will be preserved, and central banks will be able to return. They have the tools to return inflation to relatively stable, relatively low levels. And that's what I expect to see after the immediate shocks are behind us.
The only issue, and I'm not one from the wages are inflation camp. You know, I know that we're a year apart and we were in school at the same time. And I remember the 70s because I was on many, many lines of strikes for wages and supporting of workers. I'm a big supporter of private sector unions. I think they need to go battle and get what they want and get what they need, more importantly. I know that the air traffic controllers strike that was crushed by Reagan sent a message, and the corporations in America got it. And the movement, you know, I've always struggled with the Phillips curve when I was in graduate school back in the 70s. Understand it because it didn't have a global basis to it. And the American worker has taken it on the chin as the Berlin Wall came down, for lack of a better but it had already started to change with the Chinese. And of course, under Deng Xiaoping, it changed far more dramatically and put pressure on U.S. wages. So if U.S. wages are sticky up as workers get more here, so be it. That's just one we're going to have to live with, and everything's going to adjust. And the first thing that should adjust is that Wall Street and the stock and corporations should stop running record profits, and those profits should be coming out of historically high earnings and headed to wages. Must peak be, and R is greater than G. Well, time to shift that a little bit. So that wouldn't be a bad thing.
So I can conclude with an anecdote for you, Ira, that you were mentioning energy shortages, giving rise to fertilizer shortages, giving rise to other problems earlier. You know why we got Chinese economic reform in 1979 and Deng Xiaoping. The answer is energy shortages. They did not discover the new oil fields that they had programmed into the latest 10-year plan. Energy shortages that led to fertilizer shortages, which threatened the agricultural sector, which was the bulk of the Chinese economy. So they had to reform. And here we are half a century later.
Yeah, that's a great point. And this time they have a lot of money, unlike, and that's not going to solve their problems. They've got some serious problems. But that's why, and I know we're going to stop here. But I turn to Michael Pettis's views that if China really shifts to a more middle class oriented society, which means, of course, being more consumer demand driven, the yuan is going to have to shock a lot of people, because you cannot go down that road with a weak yuan. That was mirroring the Japanese miracle when they were totally export oriented. But if you're going to change and pivot to a much, not to a much more, I mean, we've already seen consumer consumption grow from, I think, 39% to about 46%. But I think the Chinese last year did it very well, because where many people predicted a weaker yuan, because of course the model was, well, global economy is slowing, China has to protect its exports, the yuan has to get weaker. But in fact, from probably June of 2020 until now, in fact, the yuan closed today at about 642 and a half, yuan has strengthened. And with that came, I think, Chinese stockpiling of raw materials. And what told me that is that in the height of the global slowdown, copper prices were rising, iron ore was rising, and more importantly, food prices, soybeans, wheat, corn, we can go on and on, were rising even into record crops. So something was diverging from the usual and the standard mode of thinking. And I think that had to do with the Chinese were very aware that the Fed was going to try to weaken the dollar with the swap lines and taking interest rates to zero in an effort to ensure demand stayed high. And with the fiscal stimulus, they went the other route. And I found that very interesting. And they pushed global prices, I think, very much by themselves. So it'll be interesting to see what China does here now.
Well, great, insightful discussion. Gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Professor Eikengreen?
Well, you were kind enough, Richard, to mention at the outset that I have a new book called In Defense of Public Debt, Oxford University Press, September 2021, available at all your favorite websites.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Ira?
Yeah. And I'm, I've been laying low for a while. It's been about a month, 5 weeks. I haven't blogged, but Notes from Underground, I'll be back. And this is actually a good way for me to get back to writing the blog. There's a lot of things discussed here that I think have great value. And I know a lot of my readers which are a lot, have a lot of respect for Professor Eichengreen. Of course, one of my favorites is a graduate school chum of mine, Kevin McCarthy, is a big fan. So there, and on these podcasts, Richard, so these are the way that I get out there. And of course, I'm in a couple of chat rooms where, but you know, that's really geared. This has been really good because we take the theoretical and really make it practical. And as Deng Xiaoping was so fond of saying, practice is the sole criterion of judging truth. So this is a good way to ferret it out. And this has really been a great opportunity.
Great. Thank you so much, gentlemen, Professor Eichengreen and Ira. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. This was really a great honor for me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both.